Okay, so this is what I thought of doing. So this is the program for the rest of the course. I will make a very brief intro to calculus of variations, because we will be using them as a basic tool. So I think this is a must. Then we'll go into, first of all, definition. I mean, just very brief introduction to differential geometry. And in fact, what we will do at the end of the day is use calculus of variations of functionals which are geometric. I will show you what is important, and this would be our basic tool by which we analyze images, surfaces, etc. After defining curves, we will introduce some motion to the curves. Of highly important is curve evolution according to various heat equations. I know that you heard about it before, but still I would like to introduce that. So a little bit of curve evolution. And obviously the way to implement them by level sets. And I will also link back to calculus of variations. I mean, Salim showed yesterday a couple of connections of how, first of all, to take a curve, evolving it, and then going back to the image. I will close this loop from, I hope, a little bit of a different perspective. A related problem is the fast marching method of solving iconal equations. Okay, if and up to this point, all the equations that we are dealing with are more or less diffusion equations, here we will solve an equation which looks like a gradient of t equals some g of x and y. And I will show with a very simple proof the relation to the geodesic active contour that we will comment about on the actually tomorrow. And tomorrow, I will talk about active contours. And if I have time, I will talk about various modern methods for shape reconstruction. I will review the existing methods, what Kinect is doing, what Intel is doing, what Sony is doing. I mean, this would be the end talk. And what is random dot stereograms, autostereograms, how you reconstruct, how do you actually apply these methods in order to do efficient reconstruction. What do Microsoft actually doing in their gesture recognition? I mean, what is going on behind the scenes over there, and how to make it more efficient. I mean, this is still research, an ongoing research, but it's very practical and I think interesting. So first of all, to the basics, calculus of variations. So calculus of variation in general. Yep. I have. Oh yeah. I actually have. How many talks do I have? Yeah. So no, tomorrow I meant tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it would be somewhere around here. I don't know exactly how fast I will go, but this would be. So tomorrow I meant tomorrow. I thought I lost it for a while. So you should be familiar with calculus of variations. In general, it's a generalization of regular calculus in which we would like to find a minimizer or extremizer of a given functional. So instead of a function, we're talking about a functional, something that wraps the function u. So we are looking for an optimal u, or a maximizer or minimizer of this integral form. We do that by introducing a variation to u, and what we get as the output is this sort of Euler-Lagrange equation or Euler-Lagrange condition that applies a differential rule to the functional, to the argument of the functional. And it produces the condition by which the minimizer should satisfy. Okay. So from an integral equation, we get at the end a differential equation which should be satisfied. It's now let me show the resemblance to. So let me first of all give an example. So if, for example, we measure the length of a curve, so what is written over there? I mean, if we have a function. And please let me know if I'm going to basic things. I mean, I can accelerate if you'd like. But if I have a length, okay, this is a function, and I would like to measure the length, so it should be dx squared plus dy squared along the length here, along the curve here. And if I integrate it over some parametrization, then I should take dx squared plus dy squared. I can now divide everything by dx, so what I get is integration. And again, this is some abusive notation. I allow myself as an engineer to do that. Square root of 1 plus yx squared. Now I have to divide and multiply by dx, so I have dx here. So what you have here is the integration over the length of a curve between two points. If we apply the previous equation, the Euler-Lagrange equation, to this quantity, then what you do is first of all take the derivative according to x, and you apply it on the partial derivative according, let's go back and see what is going on exactly there. Okay, so you take the derivative according to x to the derivative according to u of x, okay? So this is the full derivative and this is the partial derivative, so you apply that on y of x, okay? And then you apply this equation to 1 plus yx squared. This partial derivative means that we treat y of x as a symbol, we take the derivative, and then we apply y of x, d of x over the result, full derivative. So what we get is something which has geometric meaning. I mean, if we take the derivative of a curve, then what we get is the following equation, which is nothing but the curvature of this curve, okay? So in a sense, asking what is the most efficient way. So we all know, well, this is the proof that the shortest line connecting two points should be a straight line. Why? Because if this should be equal to zero, then yx should be equal to a constant, and therefore there should be the minimal path connecting these two points should be a line. It also tells us that the curvature of a line, the curvature is 1 over the osculating circle at each and every point. So if we take three points that define a circle, we let them shrink to a point, they define a circle, the 1 over the radius of this osculating circle is defined as the curvature. So for straight line, the curvature is infinity, 1 over infinity, roughly speaking, is 0. So if this was an initial curve that I drew between these two points, an initial function, if I now use this equation, the Euler-Lagrange equation, as a gradient descent process, it would flow it into a straight line, hopefully. It still needs to be proven. If you would have taken a function, okay, this is just a little bit about the philosophy behind calculus of variation. If you would have taken a function, f of x, and we ask the following question. Multiply this function, we make things a little bit complicated in order to find the external point. Multiply this function by a different function, eta, such that eta gets can be arbitrary. And now take the derivative with respect to this variation that we add to the function. What we would get eventually is a new definition of the, well, you can see over there. We take perturbation around x, epsilon times eta, And we ask, when would the derivative, according to this arbitrary eta times epsilon, and I take the derivative with respect to epsilon, should be equal to zero. Now, this is overdoing the derivative definition, but still, at the end of the day, what we get is that the first derivative should be equal to zero, which means that this is an interesting way of isolating maximal points, minimal points, and inflection points. We can actually use the gradient, the derivative as a gradient descent process, and flow a point to its local minima or maxima. It depends how we use it. So we define the following evolution equation. X at time delta t should be equal to the original x minus dt times the derivative, which would flow eventually, if I now apply it iteratively as a differential equation, it would flow the point to its local minimum. Okay, so this is the calculus of variation approach. What we'll do is exactly the same for curves. Okay, so if you got that, you got the basic idea behind what we will be doing in the next. So in calculus of variations, instead of perturbing a point, what we do is we perturb a function. So we add this eta, now eta is a function rather than a scalar, to the original function u. So this is eta of x, it can be arbitrary, and for example, let's assume without lots of generality that it is equal to zero at the boundaries of the domain. And now we take the derivative according to epsilon of this new function, of this function plus the perturbation, and at the end of the day we get this equation, and as I've told you, in a very similar way to that to what we did with curves, we can now flow what we did with a function, we can now flow a curve or a function according to this functional. So if, for example, we take the function that we have shown over here and we move y according to its so we take some new parameter t and we use y so that we take something like that. What we get is basically the total variation or the curvature flow for a curve. Now this is not exactly the curvature flow because there are some issues over there, normalization, freedom from parameterization, we will talk about it, but this is more or less the principles behind behind the flow, the gradient descent flow that is obtained by from the derivative of the functional, from the Euler-Lagrange equation, or the first variation of this function with respect to u. So if we do that, eventually we will get a straight line connecting these points. So this is just the formal definition of how we get an Euler-Lagrange equation. We can actually also write functionals. I mean, the same equation can be done for a parameterized curve. For example, if we have C of p, which is nothing but x of p and y of p. Okay, so this is a planar curve. Then we can define the length to be integration over dx square plus dy square exactly as before, but now I divide and I multiply by dp. Okay, so let's divide and multiply by dp, and what we get at the end of the day is that it should be equal to, now the parameterization is from 0 to 1, assume that p goes from 0 to 1, and what we get at the end of the day is that we get square root of xp square plus yp square dp, and the shorthand notation for that is cp dp. So this is yet another way of writing the arc length of the curve. If I now take the Euler-Lagrange equation, now I get two equations, because I introduce perturbation to x and perturbation to y, so I get two equations. And these equations are nothing but the curvature times the normal, okay, with the minus sign. It is also equal from differential geometry to the second derivative of the curve according to its arc length. And I will talk about it later. And this is why when we take a curve and we flow it according to its curvature, very nice things happen. Very nice things happen, and I will mention it now. Gage and Hamilton proved that convex curves converge in finite time to a circular point. And Grayson scooped Hamilton yet again by proving that any non-convex curve, first of all, become convex in finite time. This time is proportional to the area of the curve, of the area bounded by the curve. It's very easy to prove that, so we will prove it in this actually today. I mean, to prove that the time is equal to the area. It's very complicated to prove that indeed any convex, non-convex curve becomes become convex. And if you think about it, what Grayson did here, this is the wonderful theorem by Grayson. What Grayson did here is actually very similar to what, in a sense, to what Perlman did to Hamilton with the Ricci flow, with the Poincaré conjecture. Okay, so from that point of view, this is an interesting equation. It is also called the heat equation or the geometric heat equation because we have here a second derivative according to the arc length. Okay, so this is a length minimization equation. It is also geometric heat equation. So this is it. This is the analogy. If we have a function, we take the derivative with respect to x, we can flow a point to its minimum point. If we take the derivative with respect to a function, we get an evolution to the function. Okay? So now we marked a big X on calculus of variations, and we can start working. Whenever I stop a chapter, please feel free to raise hands, ask questions. I mean, this is why I'm here from. So, brief introduction to differential geometry, the very basic stuff. When we are talking about a parameterized curve, parameterized by P, for example, and again, just assume that P is given between 0 and 1, so it's a mapping between the unit interval to R2. We call CP the tangent, the first derivative according to the arc length, to the parameterization, and it's thinking about a car driving on a road. Okay, the second derivative is the acceleration. It is not the curvature if we don't choose P to be arc length. So what is an arc length? In Euclidean geometry, what we know is that length is preserved. Length in the intuitive way. So if length is preserved, we can use it in order to define length. How should we do that? So this is our curve in 2D space. And since length is preserved, we look for a parameterization, some parameterization S, so that, small s, so that the derivative, the simplest way of defining length, is such that the derivative, which is nothing but the length here, the magnitude of the derivative should be equal to 1. Oh, I saw that there is a trick here. Otherwise, we have a vanishing board. Okay. So let's take the magnitude of this derivative. Okay, let's take the magnitude of this derivative. And this is how I would, or this is how I would like to define it, with some power here, so that the integration over this quantity, let's do it like that. DP should be equal, should be reparameterization invariant. Okay, so this is length, in a sense, and I'm looking for something which should be also reparameterization invariant. So if, for example, I write instead of P, I would like to move from P to R. Let me first of all kill that. Oh, it's nice, you don't see it here. If, for example, you write, so what I did here is moved from P to R, so what I have is basically, let's write here alpha, so what I have is basically CP, P of alpha, let's write it R, R of alpha, and here I have RP to alpha, okay? And here should come DP. Now I would like to actually kill this dp so that the this functional is reparameterization invariant, and the trick to do that is setting alpha to be square root of, I mean, 1 over 2. Okay, so it should be the square root, it should be the magnitude of rp. If I do that, then everything simplifies and we get, so setting alpha to be 1 over 2, what I get is cr here, the magnitude of the gradient, times dr. And we get equivalence. So the arc length in the Euclidean case is defined by, now why did I do this trivial exercise? The reason I did that is because when we will start dealing with affine transformations, it is less trivial to define invariant arc length, and we have to go through the same procedure again. Did you talk about affine invariant arc? No, okay. So we have the definition of invariant arc length, which is Euclidean arc length, which is nothing but the velocity times the time. Okay, you can think about the change, the velocity. This is the change of the curve according to P, is nothing but the velocity. Velocity multiplied by time is nothing but the change in length. Okay, so this is the intuition behind it. Another nice thing about the velocity, I mean, once we have defined Euclidean arc length of traveling along a curve, then the first derivative would be the tangent, unit tangent. So it is as if driving along the curve with constant velocity. And if you drive with a car on a road with constant velocity, then the acceleration will always be orthogonal to the road. Okay, so if you take a turn, the acceleration will always be along the line which is orthogonal to your direction of driving. Okay, and the magnitude of this acceleration would be nothing but the curvature. Okay, so the first derivative of the curve is the speed, making it one is what we do by defining the Euclidean arc length. The second derivative is nothing but the curvature. So we learned about the curvature. Another nice thing about the curvature is that it is 1 over the radius of the oscillating circle, as I said before. Now, what happens when we introduce more complicated transformations and we would like to account for those? How should we treat more complicated transformations? So the second interesting transformation is, for example, the affine transformation. So the affine transformation is just a 2x2 matrix that is applied to all coordinates in the plane, plus translation. Let's ignore for a moment the translation. And for simplicity, let's restrict our discussion to equi-affine transformation, for which we have that the determinant of A is equal to 1. Why do we do it? Because it's simpler. Because we have to, when we'll restrict ourselves to something like that, everything, the heat equation would be simple and everything would be relatively trivial to deal with. So if we do that, what would happen is that instead of having affine transformation as before, that can actually shrink. So think about the coordinates as being skewed like that, and one of them is stretched, and then you get these effects. If we restrict now the area, if we restrict the determinant to be 1, that it would be area preserving. Area preserving would look like that. I know because I generated these shapes. Now, why am I doing this exercise? Why do we need curvatures and why do we need arc length in image analysis? So the simplest, or not the simplest, one of the interesting games that we give kids as they grow up is this jigsaw puzzles. You have these parts and you would like to match them one to the other. So think about curves, two-dimensional curves, that define the boundary of two-dimensional shapes, and you would like to match one shape to the other. The question is how to do that. And the most trivial way to do it is plot as one axis the arc length, and the other one should be the curvature. Okay? This is, you can integrate the curvature. I mean, if you integrate the curvature twice, then what you get is the curve back up to the rotation and translation. Okay? So the first integration would give you the invariance to translation, and the other one to rotation. Actually, the second one to translation, the first one to rotation. Okay? Because in the first one you get the tangent direction. Then integration would be up to translation in the plane. So we get from the first curve we get one graph. From the second curve we get a second graph. But there is still a problem. If I don't know how to choose the initial point, then these two graphs would not match to one another. So from an engineering point of view, if you get two graphs that you would like to match up to rotation to one another, what would you do? I mean, anyone has any idea? What would be the most trivial engineering trick to take two functions, two periodic functions, and match them to one another? I mean, in electrical engineering, it's trivial. When I'm giving this talk to electrical engineering, immediately they tell me, take the Fourier transform, throw away the phase, and then just match them. And this is true. This is, you throw away part of the information, and everything is fine. When I give this course to mathematicians, they sometimes tell me, go to Cartan theorem, which tells you, here you have one freedom, one parameter that you can control. Get rid of it by just taking the curvature and the derivative of the curvature with respect to the arc length. Apparently, this type of curve is a unique signature for this shape. Okay, it's unique signature up to translation and rotation. So this is the Cartan theorem, and we can use that. Okay, so this is for the Euclidean case. And we just shift the other signature so that it would eventually match. And for and using the Cartan theorem, what we need to do is take another derivative of the curve. This is just a schematic sketch. It's not exactly the signature of this shape. And then we have and then the other shape should match the first without any problems, eliminating the translation property. The issue with Cartan theorem is that it is beautiful mathematically, but it is useless practically because we need to get to third order derivative, and third order derivatives, the more derivatives that you introduce, if you observe it from the Fourier domains, it's like multiplication, the frequency by omega, by f, by the, so basically any small perturbation would completely destroy the signature. So we'll have numerical problems working with this kind of signatures. Third order derivative is actually almost impractical to work with. So we can take shapes, find the signatures, and solve our jigsaw puzzles. And actually, this was one of the exercises that I gave a couple of years ago when I gave this course at Stanford. And one student came up with an interesting solution. This was Mickey Lustig. Those of you who are dealing with MRI and sparsity probably know this guy. Now, what happened with affine transformations? Why do affine transformation important? I mean, when I look at the class and I shift a little bit, everything moves more or less, I mean, locally, affinely. If I observe a plane from a distance, then things are two-dimensional. When I approximate a perspective locally, things are more or less affine. I mean, the transformation that goes between local patches is more or less affine. So affine transformation is important in computer vision. So we would like to analyze what is going on there. This is yet again the affine transformation, and we limit ourselves to equi-affine. We could get rid of that afterwards. So how should we design an affine invariant arc length? Remember, in the Euclidean case, we knew that length is preserved. In the equi-affine case, we have another quantity which is preserved. Okay, the area. How should we generate area? So how should we generate area? We have the curve. Its general parameterization is P. Okay, this is C of P. And I would like to find out a new parameterization, V, such that area is preserved. Okay, for length, I had to take one derivative. For area, I have to resort to a second derivative. Okay, so what I do is something really simple. I'm taking the determinant, the cross product of these two vectors, C and CVV. And I would like this cross product, let me delete the pre-Cartan signature, and I would like this parallelogram, the area of this, of the cross product of these two vectors, to be equal to 1. Okay, so now instead of writing the dot product, I would write the determinant of CV and CVV as so. And I would like this one to be equal to 1. How should I do that? I define a new parameterization dv, or let's call it v, which is equal to cv, cvv. This is the cross product. Remember, this is the determinant of the matrix by some alpha dv. So there should be some p here. Now, affine geometry goes back to Blaschke. There is a very nice book from the 80s by Bouchin who put everything in order. And it is analogous to calculus of variations in Euclidean spaces, and it's very nice. Yeah. Actually, affine geometry is defined only for local convex curves. We will extend the concept to non-convex curves as well. This is something that which is defined locally, differentially. I didn't talk about closed curves. Oh, the area is preserved locally as well as globally. So I'm looking for a differential form that would preserve the area. Okay, this should be always one. No matter how I drive on the curve, it should be one. Which parameterization of the curve would give me something like that? Okay? So I told you that I would like this guy to be a reparameterization invariant, so there should be an alpha here. What is this alpha? Let us rewrite it. So if we take from C of P to C of R, then we have RP. And taking the second derivative, we have CRR RP square plus CR RPP. Okay, so this should be CPP and CP. And now I'm moving from P to R parameterization. So what is going on here is that I have CP, that's right, CR RP cross product with CRR RP square plus CR RPP. Okay, this is the determinant of this, and this should be something like that. What is the cross product of CR and CR? What is the cross product of two parallel vectors? Yeah, zero. So this can go away. So what I have here, basically, oh, the other one, yeah. So this goes away. So what I have here is that I have CR, CRR, alpha, times RP to the power of 3 times alpha, dP. So what should be alpha then? In order to get rid of P here? Yeah, so alpha should be exactly 1 over 3. So if alpha is 1 over 3, then what I get here is CRR 1 over 3 dr. Okay, so this should be a reparameterization invariant of arc length, which is affine invariant. Now, without loss of generality, I can plug here the Euclidean arc length. Okay, why? Because it is reparameterization invariant, so I'm just choosing the Euclidean one. The first derivative according to the arc length is nothing but the tangent vector. Okay? The second derivative according to S is nothing but the curvature vector. So it should be kappa times N. I told you about it. So the cross product between them should be, I mean, we have one vector which is one vector which is curvature in the normal direction. So it should be curvature to the power of 1 over 3. ds. Okay? So this is the relation between the affine arc length and the Euclidean one. So if you have a curve, all you need to do in order to define the affine invariant arc length of it is take the curvature, multiply it by 1 over 3, take it in an absolute sense, okay? Otherwise, you will start going back along the curve, and this is how we actually extend the idea from local convex curves to non-convex curves. And here you have the affine invariant arc length. Another thing which is important. So we define the affine invariant arc length. Now we would like to define the affine invariant heat equation. In order to define the heat equation, what I have to define first is the second derivative according to the affine arc length. So if I take a curve, C of P, and I'm taking the second derivative of, oh, let's call it C of V, and I'm taking the second derivative according to V, what I have to do is be careful about it. I mean, first of all, I have to take, so it should be d over dv of cp, or let's cp dp over d over dv, where dp over dv is something that I plug over there. And then I take a second derivative, so it should be cp dp, let's call it pv, PV square plus CPP this should be CPP PR squared plus CP PVV. Okay? And you can actually relate to the arc length in a moment, to the Euclidean arc length in a moment. So what we have been doing until now is finding invariant transformations, invariant arc length with respect to a given transformation. So we wrote a functional which should be reparametrization invariant, as well as invariant under the group that we are talking about. Specifically, we tested it for the Euclidean case, in which case the length is nothing but the velocity times the time, and we get the power should be 1 over 2. And in the affine case, we got a definition. We got a definition of the area to be 1. I mean, this is a restriction that we have to impose on the problem, and thereby we got the 1 over 3 over there, because if you think about it, you need to eliminate the number of derivatives, okay? So the number of derivatives basically define the power by which you have to take this measure. Okay, and this actually makes it a geometric quantity. This allowed me to write here something which has geometric meaning. Otherwise, it would not have been reparametrization invariant. Okay, another interesting thing. So remember that in the Cartan theorem, what we did is we took the curvature, as well as the derivative of the curvature, and we got some curve. And this was after we took the curvature with respect to the invariant arc length. What should we do in the affine case? So in the affine case, what we do is we also look for the first non-trivial invariant by taking derivatives of the curve with respect to the new arc length that we have found. So if, for example, we take the definition of the arc length, of the affine arc length by CV, CVV equal to 1, and we now take another derivative with respect to this invariant arc length that we have found, then apparently, since this is linear, we can actually take the derivative with respect and then to the second, and we can split these cross products as a linear operator. Then what we get is, first of all, the cross product between two parallel vectors, which again vanish. And then the fact that the first derivative and the third derivative should be parallel. So there should be a constant. There should be a scalar that that relates between the first derivative and the third derivative. We call this constant mu. And this mu is defined as the affine invariant curvature. Okay? So this is the next invariant after the arc length. So we have a way of defining the affine invariant curvature. And therefore, we can apply exactly the same trick as we did for the Euclidean case. So instead of kappa and s, what we now have is this v and mu. Okay? So we have an invariant arc length, which is also equi-affine invariant, and there is no problem of now comparing these two curves using this type of invariant. Now, if you think about the jigsaw puzzle example, then initially what we did is observe the parts from far away and assume that everything is more or less, I mean, there is no perspective, I mean, the projection is parallel projection. Now we can start account for local affine transformation, assume that we have the puzzle over there and the camera is here, so for far away we can neglect locally the distortion due to perspective, but locally it would still be an affine transformation. Okay? So from a practical point of view, affine transformation is important. Affine transformation is also important in stereo vision. In stereo vision, what we do in order to reconstruct a 3D structure of the class, for example, I have projection on the right eye and projection on the left eye. And what I do is match between patches, I mean the projection of a point on the right eye and the projection of a point on the left eye allows me to triangulate back and estimate the depth of a specific point. Now, all this geometry is called epipolar geometry. It's a very simple geometry. What you do, basically, is you connect the two focal points of the right and the left eye, so you have one line, and you assume that your domain is spanned by all planes that go through this line. So, in a sense, If you think of this plane bisecting the left image and the right image, then you get two lines. These two lines are called the Pipolo line. And this matching process is taking a patch from the left line to a patch on the right eye, and then trying to match between them. It's a very simple process. This is why stereo vision works. It doesn't work if you don't have features. So, for example, estimating by what is known as passive stereo without projecting any patterns to smooth surfaces is difficult. It's difficult to solve because you don't have data. When you have features, when you project some pattern, when you light the scene somehow, when you take a satellite and it goes over fields and you know exactly where the corners are, then everything becomes more or less trivial. Nevertheless, there is a small affine transformation that occurs between these two images. So when you match these patches, you need to account for that. So affine transformation is important in computer vision. This is why we elaborate on that. So just one comment. When we go from surfaces, we go back to invariant measures. This is some Klein bottle. Well, let's not get into that. A surface, I define instead of, if a curve is a mapping from one-dimensional interval to 2D, a surface is a mapping from a two-dimensional interval from part of R2 into some space, for example, R3, okay? So if I, for example, map to R3, what we have over here is X, Y, and Z coordinates that take the UV parameterization satisfy and actually give me a point on the surface. The normal is nothing but the derivative of SU, the cross product of SU and SV. And if you want the normalized product, you need to normalize it. This is how an area element looks like. It's nothing but the cross product times UDV. And again, this is basic calculus. I assume we all know about it. This is how you measure area. So this is SU, SV, the normal. And we can also consider functions, which is nothing but taking X to be U, Y to be V, and then the third coordinate is Z of U and V. What else do we need to know about surfaces? If we take a curve and put it on the surface, then we can parameterize it by its arc length, exactly as we did before, okay? So the length is now, instead of being the x square plus the y square, it's the x square plus the y square plus the z square, and assume that it is restricted to the surface. So I have a curve which is parameterized according to its arc length. The first derivative would be the tangent vector. The second derivative would be the curvature vector. Again, osculating circle, everything is nice however, since this curve is interacting with the surface, I can now take the two following components of this vector. One of them should belong to the tangent plane, to the plane tangent to the point to the surface at that point, and the other one should be along the normal direction. So the first curvature is called the geodesic curvature, which is nothing but the curvature vector. And I subtract here the projection onto the normal direction. And the other one is called the normal curvature. Okay? Why am I talking about it? Because we will use geodesic curvature and geodesics. A geodesic is a curve for which the geodesic curvature is equal to zero. Okay? And one way to get geodesics is taking a curve and moving it according to a geodesic curvature, and thereby flowing it towards its minimal, or at least locally minimal, curve. If you start, for example, on a globe with a curve, and you flow it and you fix two points, then it would converge to the great circle, to the section of the great circle that connects these two points. Okay, so we define the curvatures, the normal curvature and the geodesic curvature. With that, we can define the mean curvature and the Gaussian curvature. How do we do that? If you look at all the curves around the point, then for each curve, for each direction of a curve, we get a different normal curvature. Okay? Along one direction, principal, it should be principal, I made a mistake over there. Along one direction, we should get a maximum of this curvature. Along another direction, which is orthogonal to the first, we get a minimum one. The multiplication of them is called the Gaussian curvature. The sum of them, the average of them, is called the mean curvature. Okay? So this is the mean curvature and this is the Gaussian curvature. It is important to know that for curves we had a single curvature. For surfaces in R3, we have two types of curvatures. The nice thing about the Gaussian curvature is that it is isometric invariant. I mean, it doesn't really matter how you embed the surface in 3D space. For each and every point, it would always have the same Gaussian curvature. Okay? So think about the paper. You embed it differently in 3D space, the Gaussian curvature would always be zero. I mean, since one of the curvatures here is zero, it doesn't really matter if I generate an effective curvature in a different direction, the multiplication would always vanish. Okay? The remarkable theorem by Gauss actually showed that you can actually integrate over the Gaussian curvature over the surface and get these invariants that define the topology of the surface. I hope I'm not teaching anything new here, but still, these are things that I have to say. So what I have defined so far in this short introduction is the curvature, the normal, the tangent, the arc length, the affine invariant arc length, the mean curvature, the Gaussian curvature, the two principal curvature, not principal, but principal curvature, geodesic curvature, the normal curvature, and the tangent plane. Now we are ready, and you should tell me if I should take a 5 minute break before the last 5 minute break. Or if you're willing to continue, no problem. So now we start introducing motion into the game. Let's do that. So we have the same curve as before. We have the reparametrization invariant arc length, like the Euclidean and the affine one. So this was the Euclidean, and then there was the affine one. Let me jump to a different presentation because here you will not be able to see the videos. So now we are talking about curve evolution. The same, but with Microsoft as a driver. So what we have over here is a curve that we start to flow. Okay, so we added another parameter to the curve. It's called T. And now we take what is known as the geometric heat equation. And the nice thing about the geometric heat equation is that it is invariant to Euclidean transformation. So if I flow it for a while here, and I flow it for a while, for the same while there, the same transformation that's related between the original objects would still apply to the ones that I flow for the same time. Okay? And as I told you, so this is an application of this flow, and you can see how this cat is vanishing eventually at a point. So this is an implementation of the Grayson theorem. So what is the Grayson theorem? The Grayson theorem is that given the curvature flow, you get any initial curve, and it would flow into a circular point in finite time, which is proportional to the area inside the curve. Along the evolution, embedding is preserved, which means that the curve does not intersect itself. Okay? So this part of the proof was proven by Gage and Hamilton, and that part of the proof, which involves a lot of delicate analysis of many cases, was proven by Grayson. Okay. There is another thing which is important when we go to analyze the affine flow, and this is the following. When we look at a curve which is evolving according to any vector field at each and every point in the curve, what we need to account for, if the flow is geometric, in a sense that if the flow does not depend on the parameterization of the curve, what we need to account for is only the normal parameterization, or the normal component of this flow. So we can take this vector and consider only the normal component of this of the given flow. Okay? The proof is by Gage and Epstein. And it's not so such a complicated, and as well as in my book, and it's not such a complicated proof. The motivation for that is that the other component along the tangent direction accounts only for reparametrization of the points of the points which represent this curve. So they would account only for the way that we represent the curve. Now, if the flow is geometric, we do not care about how it is represented. So the only component which is important, if we are given an evolution like that, ct equal to some velocity field, should be the projection of the velocity into the normal direction, and then considering only the normal direction evolution. And as I told you, it is important when we analyze the affine invariant flow. So remember that in the affine case, area is preserved, and thereby we get this kind of arc length. Okay, this is the affine invariant arc length. So we can now take the second derivative and ask what is CVV as a function of arc length, for example. So if we take the second derivative according to the arc length, to the affine invariant arc length, what we get, so CVV is equal to kappa 1 over 3 in the normal direction plus something in the tangent direction. There is a derivative of the curvature here. Okay? This part is insignificant from a geometric analysis point of view. So when I am analyzing CT equals CVV, the geometric equation that I would like to analyze is basically kappa 1 over 3 in the normal direction. And this is, in a sense, a miracle. It was discovered by Sapiro and in Sapiro's PhD, as well as Alvarez, Guichard, Jones, Morel paper, axiomatic approach to image processing. Okay, they came to it from a different perspective, and Guillermo came to this conclusion from a question posed by Freddy Brookstein at the time, that was looking at a paper by Benjamin Kimya, who did curvature flow with the Levenset method, and then he asked what would be the invariant version of that. So the initial hint was, look, if we are optimizing for length, let's optimize with respect to this arc length, which was a mistake, because you cannot do anything, you cannot even analyze this equation. If you take the Euler-Lagrange equation of that, there are some difficulties working with that. However, if you take the heat equation, which is not a result of an optimization problem, of a functional, but just the heat equation, which is affine invariant, then you get something beautiful. And in fact, the Levenset implementation for that is something which is almost straightforward. You don't have to account for higher derivatives than 2. It is stable. In fact, the 1 over 3 here kills the denominator. And you can deal with the non-linearity of it by very simple measures. Yeah, what you do is the most trivial expansion, and this is just treat it as it is written here. Okay? That's it. I mean, the moment you define the arc length to be kappa 1 over 3 ds, then the rest follows. This would be the trivial extension. No. It's the same idea. You take it with the sign here. Take the sign out, take the absolute value 1 over 3, and you get this equation. This is the beautiful thing about it. And actually, you can prove the same phenomena that any affine... and this was a little bit less trivial to prove, it would converge eventually to an elliptical point. Okay? Satisfying the embedding property along the way, and everything would still apply. Let me talk about a different flow. Why? Because it is important. let me call, so what we have seen until now are the following two flows. The first of all was the geometric heat equation, and the second one was the, so we looked at Ct equals kappa n. This was the geometric heat equation. The second one was Ct equals kappa 1 over 3n. This was the affine invariant geometric heat equation. And let's deal with another one, which is 1 times n. Okay, this is called the offsets or the a constant flow. And it is related to the Huygens principle. Why? Because each point along the curve is moving in its normal direction with a constant velocity. So you can think about what would happen when the curve starts colliding with itself. Okay, I have this curve, which has this local maximal curvature, and each and every point goes with unit velocity along its normal. So I get that all these normals would collide exactly at 1 over kappa, okay? After a distance of 1 over kappa. So what should I do then? If I continue the evolution, what would happen is I would get something that looks like that, and we call it a cusp. If I apply some small diffusion to that, okay, so if I add here epsilon times curvature in the normal direction, which means that as I get here local singularity in the curvature, okay, so I have this singularity in the curvature, something else would kick in and start operating, then we get into a new ballpark of what is known as viscosity solutions or physically feasible solutions. So in this case, there are these two curves that propagate outwards, and therefore they collide, and the question is what would happen here in the middle. And in this case, there is a single curve that propagates inwards, and there is a singularity here, and the question is what to do afterwards. And one way to consider that is from a physical point of view, and that is saying, look, when two points collide, they vanish, and therefore you need to apply some sort of smoothing effect like that would happen when the curve collides with itself. Okay, so you need to eliminate them somehow. By the way, the curve would continue colliding with itself at a set of at a really nice set of points in curve evolution. They are called shocks. In shape analysis, it is called the skeleton of a shape, and the skeleton of a shape is like the stick figure. Okay. If I have a shape and I evolve it at a constant velocity inwards, then what I would get is something that looks like that. The skeleton of a shape would always have the connectivity of the shape. So if I have a shape which has holes, the skeleton would also be a circle. It is very sensitive to noise. For example, if I have here a small perturbation, then what I will have is this branch that spans out from the skeleton. And this is, by the way, the way that small kids capturing the shape of features. Why? Because if you think about it, the skeletons are the points at which information disappears, information vanishes. And this is a very compact way of thinking about information, okay? So these skeletons have been researched by many in the computer vision literature. I think Baum was among the first. And what to do with them is still a very good question, but at least our brain is really sensitive to these kinds of structures. If you keep the distance from the boundary along the skeleton, then this is just yet another representation of the shape. Okay? So if at each and every point we still keep the distance, the time at which the normals collide, then we can reconstruct back the surface, the shape itself. So these are the skeletons, these are the set of shocks, and if we allow the curve to continue and collide with itself, then what we practically do is introduce this diffusivity into the game. In a sense, yes. You need to be careful how you define it.
Well,
It is defined only inside the curve, but in a sense, yes. There are many, there are at least 20 equivalent definitions of the skeleton, medial axis and stuff like that, and but you need to be careful of how you do it at the end of the day. In order to analyze what is going on with these three equations, how they modify the area, how they modify the curvature, and how they modify the length, let us first of all define the area, the length, and the curvature. So the curvature was defined before. The area is defined, as we learned in basic calculus, nothing but the integration over the cross product between the curve, the coordinate of the curve, and its tangent. Okay, so we accumulate these small triangles. Okay, so we have some origin, and this is the cross product. This is half the cross product between c and the velocity vector. And as we integrate it, we get negative triangles as we go along that direction, and we got positives one along that direction. They cancel one another, and at the end of the day, what we get is the area of the surface of the object. Okay. So this is the area. The length. We already know how to measure length, okay? It's the velocity times the time along the curve, so we know how to define it. We also know what is going on with these curves. For example, when we apply constant velocity, the curves start colliding with itself and can separate into separate objects. Okay, so if you take something like that, then the curvature flow would lead it into a circular point. The same goes for the equiaffine flow. It would converge into an elliptical point. The constant flow would create something like that, okay? Two separate curves. So we'll do the analysis for the constant flow up to the point where we have collisions. Afterwards, we'll have to assume something else. Okay, so we have a way of measuring this, of measuring area, a way of measuring length, and we have the equations themselves. Now let's analyze what is going on with them. So if we take the length and ask the question, how would the length change in time? So we take the derivative according to t and plug it into the definition of the length. What we do is we take, bless you, is we take, we can switch the order of derivatives if it is a general parameterization. So if it's p and t, we can change the order. If it's p and s, we need to be more careful about it. And at the end of the day, we get that the change of the length, let me write here, the change of the length is nothing but, so L of t is nothing but v integral of v times the curvature, ds. The change of the area is nothing but integration of minus v, ds. And the change of the curvature is nothing but vss plus kappa square v. Okay? What? Yeah, V is 1. This is V. V is 1 here. V is kappa 1 over 3 here. And V is kappa here. We'll plug V inside and thereby do the analysis. Okay, so we have these three quantities that we can just plug any flow that we would like and find out what is going on with the flow. And again, differentially. Okay, so first of all, for the constant flow. For the constant flow, if we plug 1 inside the curvature, so integration, so the nice thing about curvature that I forgot to tell you about is that the curvature is nothing but, well, I told you about it yesterday, is nothing but the theta over the s. Okay, it's the change, it's the rate of the change of the orientation of the tangent. So if we integrate with respect to the s over a closed curve, what we get is exactly 2 pi. Okay, so the rate of change of length is 2 pi. So if the curve would not intersect itself, it would vanish in a finite time, which relates to the original length of the curve. Okay, L0 divided by 2 pi. The curvature, it's very easy to give an equation to the curvature at time t. This is nothing but the Riccati equation. And the reason for that, the intuition behind it is very simple. I mean, if you have, as long as the curve does not intersect itself, then take the original curvature, the original curve, okay? And this is the center of the oscillating circle at a point. And after a while, what would happen is that you will have an oscillating circle at exactly the same point, but the only change that would happen is this one, is the time, okay? So if you take R2 as being R1 minus T, then what you get is exactly this Riccati equation. And you can also see where singularities occur. Singularities occur exactly after 1 over kappa, okay, when T is equal to 1 over kappa. So the singularities will occur exactly at this time, okay, at rho. So, and this is the analysis for the, so the change, the rate of the change in area is minus the length, which means that the longer the curve, the faster the area would vanish. And there is another nice thing about it. If you read the paper, one of my papers, which is called Fast Edge Detection, it's in a book by Osher and Nikos Paragios. It's a chapter that I wrote, so it's on my web for, I think, under miscellaneous or something like that. And over there, I repeat a proof that was, a trivial proof that says that, look, if you'd like to minimize the area of a curve, okay, so if you'd like to minimize CP, dP, then what you get is basically that the Euler Lagrange should be the normal direction. Okay? So, moving a curve according to its normal direction is the, in a sense, the most efficient way, at least differentially, to reduce its area. Okay? So this is the analysis for constant flow. For curvature flow, we plug to these equations over there the curvature. So what would happen when we plug the curvature into the length? So we get integration over kappa square. We don't, I mean, the analysis there is not so clear. The change of the area. The change of the area is very nice. Why? Because if I plug kappa, if I plug instead of V, kappa, the curvature, then what we get is that the change of the area is equal to minus 2 pi. Exactly like we had with the length before that, okay? So we know that after a time which is proportional to, if the rate of the change of area is constant, then we know that after this time, the curve would vanish, okay? And we know that the curve would vanish because of the Grayson theorem that tells us that it would not intersect itself along the way, so we know exactly how much we have to wait before it vanishes. Actually, it's an interesting way of computing the area, the original area of a curve. Just apply geometric heat equation to the curve, measure when it is when it vanishes, and you get the area. And the curve could be really complicated initially. I mean, it could be really crazy before that. It would not be my choice of measuring areas of curves, yes, but still. And the curvature has this interesting equation that one could explore if you wish. I didn't. What would happen to the affine invariant flow? With the affine invariant flow, we have these complicated equations, but still, you can say something about it. I mean, there is you can start doing analysis of what happens with the isoperimetric inequality and stuff like that with the evolution, with the curve evolving in time. Okay, now towards the future. What happens if we now optimize with respect to a different kind of a measure. So if I take the following measure, instead of integrating over the S, what I plug here is now a function that depends on this, on each and every location, and looks like that. The Euler-Lagrange equation, if before it was just kappa in the normal direction, should be a little bit more complicated. I mean, it should be kappa times g minus the gradient of g dot producted with the normal direction. Okay? This is called the geodesic active contour model, and if you, for example, take this kind of let me just take off the light here. If you just take this kind of equation of, if you take this kind of an image and you take g to be 1 over the gradient magnitude or something of that sort, what you get is the evolution that you see over here. Okay? So it would segment these objects out of the background and would do something interesting. I mean, here you can see that the boundary waits until there is it is being hit from the other direction, and eventually obviously this one is implemented with the level set method. Oh, it is detected as edges. It is detected as edges. You can see that it is waiting here, and if the boundary here would not hit it, it would remain. The only reason is that it is being hit. So this is, you can say that this is a feature or bug or whatever, but this is how it works. Curvature. Which diagonal line? This?
The ones of the pattern.
Uh-huh. No, you can see that you get it, but it will disappear eventually. Yeah, it's high curvature of the curve. So this is where the first part is kicking. I will give more iteration behind this equation, but this is how it looks like, for example, in this case. So you can see that you can see many weird effects. It is weird that I would say that, but geodesic active contours is not the best way of segmenting and tracking objects. And I would elaborate about it. I mean, so here, for example, it's tracking these two guys in time. We got an approval to do experiments with virtual people, so we're fine. Okay, what would happen with surface evolution? Recall the previous list of facts about the area, etc. What would happen when I minimize the area of the area of a surface instead of length, the area? What would happen is that we get exactly the same equations as before. So if I take this dA, okay, and minimize so here this is E of S, and I would like to minimize with respect to S. So the first variation of this function with respect to the surface, this is the surface S, would be nothing but the curvature, but here it would be the mean curvature in the normal direction. So if I take my surface and I evolve it according to HN, would the Grayson theorem still apply? What do you say? It would have been great if it would, but it doesn't. In fact, we don't know of any evolution that would, which is the differential, that would preserve the connectivity of a surface. So we take the, and again, the same principle holds as before. If we have a velocity, which is in some arbitrary direction, and we would like to observe only the geometry of the surface, then what we can do is take just the normal direction of this velocity. We can do it in an inverse direction, for example. Let me show you. If, for example, we have a function, and we would like to work with MATLAB, with six coordinate system. So this is a function. This is the x coordinate, and this is my function. And the function would like to evolve according to its curvature vector. I mean, the curvature vector is here it's like that, and over there it's like that, etc., etc. What I could do is generate a different velocity according to which there should be some color over there. So I can inflate deliberately. Oh, so the only color is green. It's interesting if you will see green on green. So I can take and generate a new vector field along this z direction such that the projection of this vector field onto the normal direction would produce the desired velocity. Okay? So I do this here, here, and here. It will be the same. Okay? And this is one way of playing with this projection trick the other way around. Okay, so if you think of a surface, for example, an image is a surface, and you would like to flow it according to its mean curvature, then just project the mean curvature. I mean, back project the mean curvature. It's back projection. Okay, it's not projection. Back project the mean curvature onto the z direction, onto the intensity direction, and voila, you get the velocity according to which you have to move the image in a MATLAB form, in a XY coordinate system. You can, for example, if you now optimize, instead of putting here A, you can now plug G of something here, G of S, capital S here, and what you get is this active surfaces instead of active contours. Okay, and if you use level sets for that, then topology is being resolved automatically and stuff like that. So, as a conclusion, what I've shown you is constant flow, geometric heat equations, Euclidean flow, equiaffine, and other data-dependent flow, as well as surface evolution. What I would like to do here, since I have the time, is just and this is the fastest that I have ever gone in giving a course. I should confess. Just give you a brief about level set evolution, formulation of curve evolution. And I know you heard about it, but bear with me because I hope it would be you view the same thing from a different perspective. So, given a curve, as before, we have our parameterized curve, C of P, which is a mapping, for example, from a unit interval or from a circle to the plane. What we can do is define this curve differently as the zero intersection of a function with zero. Okay, so this function gets positive values here and negative values there, and contour command in MATLAB of 0,0 would give you the boundary, would give you the set of points that describe this curve. Okay, so if I intersect this image with a straight line, what I get are these, this is the profile of the C function, and these points represent the location of the contour. Okay, the zero set of the contour. It doesn't have to be zero, but generally let's think about it as zero. Okay, one important property about level set function is the fact that the normal, for example, can be defined as the gradient of this function. Okay, and the tangent is nothing but the gradient bar. I mean, changing the coordinates of phi and negating one of them. Okay, so then you have both the tangent and the normal. How could we prove that? Let's think about the surface, the phi surface, for a moment. So this is my phi surface, and now think about a level set, and assume that this level set is parameterized according to S. Okay, so there is a curve that goes along the level set. This should be the same level set, okay? If you're skiing, this is where you have to walk. So the derivative of phi according to S should be equal to zero. You don't lose any height or you don't gain any height when you take the derivative according to this arc length. I mean, this is the derivative according to the curve according to S. But if you now take the derivative by parts, then what you have is phi x xs plus phi ys, which is nothing but gradient of phi times cs, which tells us that the gradient of phi is perpendicular to c of s. Okay? So if this is, so c of s is nothing but the tangent in the plane that is defined, the curve, so the perspective view, this would be the gradient of phi. So we can conclude without further ado that the gradient, normalized gradient, is nothing but the normal. And if we now take the components of the normalized gradient, I mean, we take we take phi of y and minus phi of x, and let's still keep it normalized, then this would be nothing but the tangent. Okay? In a very similar manner, we could define the curvature. How do we do that? So the curvature is defined as the rate of change of the orientation, or div of the normal. And specifically, what we can do is start from a different equation, from the second derivative according to S that should be equal to zero. So if we start from phi ss, how did I write it over there? Phi ss should be equal to zero. Well, if the height doesn't change, then obviously taking the nothing that changes second derivative would also not change. So what we get here is that we get the derivative of the dot product between the gradient of phi and the tangent, and then we take the derivative by parts. So from the second part we get the curvature vector, from the first part we can switch coordinates, and at the end of the day what we can do is switch here. Instead of putting t, we plug back that part that we've computed here. And instead of n, we can plug the gradient, the normalized gradient. Okay, instead of n, we put the normalized gradient. And if we do that and rearrange terms, at the end of the day, what we get is exactly what we wanted to get. We get that the curvature is equals to nothing but the gradient normalized times, I mean, the divergent of the normalized gradient. Now, this is interesting. If this is the case, then I can write the curvature explicitly. It should be nothing but phi x square phi yy minus 2 phi x phi y phi xy plus phi y square phi xx, and I have the denominator phi x square plus phi y square to the power of 3 over 2. Why is that interesting? Because if I now take the curvature, so this is the curvature of phi, of a level set of phi. If I now take it by the power of 1 over 3, then I can see that from the denominator, the only thing that survives is gradient of phi. And sorry for switching between phi and phi. It used to be like that until PowerPoint changed its definition. Somehow, miraculously. So what we get is exactly, in the denominator, what we get is exactly, we get something, 1 over 3 divided by that. And in the level set evolution, as I will show you in a moment, what we get is that C, that is equal to V in the normal direction, translates into phi of t equals to V times gradient of phi. And this would explain to us why the denominator would be cancelled out by the affine invariant flow. So in the case of affine invariant flow, what we get is just that. we get phi x squared, phi yy, etc., etc., all the denominator. Denominator, by the power of 1 over 3. Okay, and obviously you need to take the sign before and the absolute value here. You need to be careful. Okay, so here you have a really nice filter, which is affine invariant for images. Is that good for images? Is that bad for images? We can argue about it. I can tell you that if you have two projections of an image with some noise, and this noise goes through an affine transformation, this would be the perfect way to go. It is stable, it does the right thing, and it works quite nicely. Okay, let's take a break of a couple of hours and okay.